Thanks, everybody. I'm Emily. I'm an alcoholic. Brooks, thank you so much for that. That was so sweet. And Chris, thanks for having me out here. It's an honor to be here. And I want to thank my friends who showed up tonight to support me. I love you guys very much. Sedley, love you. I got sober December, I always get confused. It was December 20th or 21st, but let's just go with the 21st of 1992. And I've been sober for 25 and a half years. And for that, I am truly grateful. I grew up in Hawaii. It was a lovely place to be a child of two very volatile alcoholic parents. My mom and father divorced actually when I was three. And my mom and father were both, as I mentioned, really, really volatile people, really actively drinking and very violent people. And I have very early memories of just anger and rage and a lot of screaming and cigarettes and the smell of alcohol. And one of my earliest memories was of my dad throwing my mom down the stairs. And she actually broke the rail, hanging on, you know, trying not to break her back. And then I have another memory of my mom actually stabbing my father in the leg with a fork. So the last thing I wanted to do was be an alcoholic like they were. But gratefully, so I did end up an alcoholic, and I ended up here. Growing up in Hawaii was great on many levels. I could escape. I could go to the beach. I spent a lot of time by myself, living in an imaginary world with imaginary people. I wished for a life that was normal, like the friends that I had. I wasn't one of those kids who had lots of friends over because my house was not a safe house. I was embarrassed, and I had a lot of shame around my life. I would wonder when I'd come home from school, if my mom was actually going to be alive often. And I actually did walk in on her one day with a shotgun in her mouth. And I was probably 8 or 9 years old. So it got to a point where I was, you know, so angry about her addiction that I used to wish for her to not live anymore. And I would fantasize about actually ending my mom's life. I hope she never goes onto this website and listens to this. But I remember feeling very alien and very different from others. And they would talk about their home lives like, you know, they were normal. They would talk about their moms and their dads and their sisters and dinners and things that normal people seem to do. And I had no experience really with that at all. And I remember sort of embellishing on what my life really was like to my friends. And sort of creating my own existence. I was so alien and awkward and uncomfortable in my own skin. And I was very angry. And I was just like that. And I was actively fight with other kids in school. And I definitely had issues focusing. Education was really difficult. Really, really difficult. I was not a great student. And I definitely found solace in the weirdos. I found my tribe. I found my people fairly early on. Once I got into high school, which, you know, I was actually asked to leave a school, a public school in high school, because I was constantly in trouble, and they found me getting high under the art building. Anywhere I could figure out a place to do it, I did. So I ended up going to Catholic school, and that was hell. And that's where I learned a really solid, good fear of God, for sure, in Catholic school. But I will say that I was grateful for the crazies that I found, because I knew, you know, that perhaps I wasn't alone in my dis-ease. And, you know, I would travel with my mom, and I would find the minibar, and I would have, like, pretend tea parties with the minibar and just drink. And, you know, I remember the first drink I had, I was three or four years old. I was really thirsty. We were living on a boat in the South Pacific, and I grabbed a quart of Hinano, because that was the only thing that was around, and I drank it. And I was little. And I remember everything started moving sideways. And I started feeling really giggly. And then I got a ton of attention. And I was like, great, I'm on to something. And therein began the search for a way to not feel the way I felt, which was chronically awful, chronically alone, chronically angry, and desperately, desperately lonely. So, yeah, you know, drinking was a very big part of my life. As soon as I found my tribe, which I've mentioned, it was a big part of what we did. And I often say in my, you know, in my shares how grateful I am for my addiction. You know, I do believe that it kept me alive for a long time, because I did often wake up and not want to live. I used to often pray that I just wouldn't wake up. I just didn't want to face my life. And, you know, the things that seem so simple, you know, getting dressed and eating and just getting to class was horribly difficult for me. You know, having to sit still and focus was almost impossible. I couldn't stand being in my own skin. And so, you know, any opportunity I had to check out, I would. And as I, you know, started to mature, you know, I found lower companions for sure. And I began to find people who were sicker than I was, which sort of gave me a sense of purpose, where I was, you know, I would think to myself, well, I can, you know, A, I'm not that bad, and B, I can fix them. So I got, you know, I would sort of take myself out of, you know, my misery and focus on someone else's misery. And I remember the very first boyfriend I had, he was called Doodoo Dan, because he had his potty mouth, the biggest stoner in school. He was a dealer, and he was my quest. He was the one that I needed to covet, and I did. I got Doodoo Dan. And actually, Doodoo Dan passed away about 3 months ago. He had a heart attack, which is not surprising and really sad. But you know, he was very sick, but he saved me from a lot of the insanity in my home life, and I needed to be saved, because you know, being alone in my home with my mom was a very, very dangerous place to be. So I'm grateful to Dan for that. And, you know, as I continued to grow, you know, I got to a point where it was time to graduate. And I graduated with an empty card. You know, they give you the diploma and a card. There was nothing in that folder. And I had to go back during the summer and get my diploma. And the reason why was, A, because I stopped showing up for school, and B, I had whitewashed Ozzy on the side of a bathroom wall, like huge, you know. So needless to say, I went back, I got my diploma, and, you know, I needed to, you know, make some money. You know, I needed to go hang with my friends and have some fun. And I managed to get through school, and I found a job. And my mom used to say I had this issue with stick-to-itiveness. I would start something and never finish it. And there was one thing that I did find that I could do, which was work. I had a pretty solid work ethic, which then became another higher power. So I had the really dysfunctional boyfriends as higher powers, and then I had work. And I could really throw myself into that and spend as much time away from home as possible. And met, you know, another really successful drug dealer. And I was 17, and he told me he was 19, but he was 29. And my mom almost had a heart attack when she found out how old he was. And I decided that I was going to stay with him in his house. And the house that he lived in was kind of a communal home owned by a guy that used to make heroin. I was just so painfully naive in my life, and just so desperately lost that I would cling to anyone who would have me. And, you know, I'm 17 years old, living in, you know, the darkest kind of environment that I could imagine living in, and I thought that I was home. You know, I'd found my people. I mean, there were people who would show up there with shotguns, and there were people who would show up there who, you know, were just, you know, strung out and needed drugs and would do anything to get them. And I would sit down and smoke cigarettes with him and talk story, as you say, in Hawaii, and hear shit that, you know, 17-year-old girl doesn't need to hear. But, you know, that's just what I needed. So I left Hawaii because I was genuinely afraid that if I didn't get off the island, that I wasn't going to live any longer, that I was going to end up in a darker place than I'd already started living in. And aside from wanting to die every day and not successfully getting there, I thought, well, if I go to California, where my father is, my, you know, most of my family was in California, you know, I'll probably be okay. So I went to California, and I was completely overwhelmed by the largeness of it. I wasn't living in really anywhere near my family. They were in L.A., and I was in Orange County. So, you know, it's a good, you know, 45 minutes, depending on traffic. And the first roommate I had was insane, naturally, because, you know, why would I attract anybody who wasn't? And she had a very healthy cocaine habit. So, you know, we hung out with some really interesting people. But for me, you know, my story doesn't involve drugs. For me, my story is really, you know, emotionally based, spiritually based, and definitely, you know, a large portion of it was finding solace in cigarettes, nicotine, and marijuana. And so I found that. And so I'm living in Orange County. I got crabs. That wasn't fun. I was mortified. So I started suffering the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization of the spirit that they talk about, where, you know, there were physical manifestations of my addiction and my disease, which were, you know, kind of bottom of the barrel, waking up in blackouts with strange people, not knowing what had happened, and then waking up with crabs. So it was pretty evident what had happened. Started really battling with a severe eating disorder. You know, it was really all about finding ways to control and manage my life. And so, you know, my disease really manifested itself in many different ways. There was, you know, the physical, where I was definitely addicted to alcohol. There was the emotional, where I was completely alienated and, you know, not a part of this world. And there was a spiritual, where I felt that God was, or, you know, the universe was a punishing entity who had nothing good for me in this life, and, you know, bore me to two crazy alcoholic parents. So I'm not down with God. So, you know, as does happen often with addicted people, we find many various ways of trying to manage and control that. And so that whole thing with work that was working for me stopped. So now starts the decline of my physical life, where, you know, I had some self-esteem in work that was starting to diminish. And I took a job at a little place called the Spaghetti Bender, who, you know, it had been in Newport Beach for 100 years as a cashier. And I had, you know, as I mentioned, I had a really tough time focusing. And so when it came time to, like, do the math and, like, cash out at the end of the night, you know, my drawer would be short. And so little did I know, but they took the shortage out of my paycheck. So I would get, like, $50 paychecks. You know, and how do you survive at 18, 19 years old on that? You know, you don't. And so then I go to my parents, I go to my mom, I go to my dad, and, you know, I feel like I'm crawling on the ground. I feel like the lowest piece of shit that one could be, desperately in need of help. I can't manage control my life. I can't feed myself. And even if I could, I wouldn't keep the food in my body because, you know, I'm dealing with this pretty severe eating disorder. And so, you know, what started happening with my family is they started to see me in my addiction, and I actually had an aunt who thought I was possessed by the devil or a devil worshiper, kind of one and the same, I guess, perhaps. And she didn't want me around. You know, she would say that, you know, you're so dark. And I was like, whatever, I'm rock and roll. What are you talking about? You know. But when I heard those voices, when I saw the looks in their eyes, I felt it deeply in my soul. And it hurt. But I was in no place to deal with that kind of hurt. So I acted out. So I found more of my lower companions, more people that I could perhaps fix, more people that I could fixate on, and other opportunities to detach from that pain. I talk about often, you know, the hole in my gut was, you know, as big as my body. I mean, there was nothing and there wasn't enough of anything that I could put in my body to fill that hole, to help me sleep at night, to help me walk across the street without wanting to cry, because I knew everybody in those cars saw me for who I was, a liar, a loser, a cheat, you know, a piece of shit human. So it was difficult for me to start to function normally. To go to a bank, I would end up in fights with the tellers. To go to the grocery store, if you looked at me the wrong way, I'd bow up, let alone if you bump me with your basket. I mean, come on, it's on. I would follow people home, and I, you know, like if you cut me off in traffic, you know, just really crazy, stupid, dangerous, angry behavior. And so I ended up finding an amazing career, and that was God doing for me what I could not do for myself. And I look back in my life, and I realize that, you know, though I'm not religious, I definitely believe in a God of my own understanding, which is a gift of recovery. And I believe that I had a God who was looking out for me from the very beginning, for sure. Or I wouldn't be here. I'd be dead. I'd be dead a long time ago. And so I was guided in a career path, and I found a job which changed my life. It ended up being what I do today, and that's, you know, almost 30 years ago. And there were circumstances, there was accountability, there were issues that, if I lost this, if I lost this job, then I lose everything. I had credibility. I had talent, recognizable talent. I'd never had that before outside of athleticism. But I fucked up. Sorry, I didn't mean to swear. There's children in the room. Ah, my bad. Earmuffs. But I goofed up on my athleticism because of my addiction. I couldn't handle, you know, the competition that went into being an athlete, let alone, like, stay up and party all night and then have to wake up for practice at 5 o'clock in the morning and run for hours. I just gave up. And that is, you know, a sad part of my story. But all that aside, I did find something else that I embraced and I grabbed onto with, you know, 10 fingers and 10 toes. And, you know, I managed and controlled that until I couldn't manage and control it anymore. And I went out with my team to a private event and got wasted. And I ended up blacking out, as I'd done numerous times before. And I came to with vomit down the front of my shirt and cigarette burns in my stockings, surrounded by weird guys that I'd never seen before and didn't know what was happening. But I realized at that moment that I came to just in time, because I was surrounded by a bunch of dudes that things probably wouldn't have gone well. So I came to, went and ate, threw up, went to sleep, woke up, threw up, and I said, I'm going to kill myself. I'm done. I've suffered pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization of the spirit in front of my coworkers, and that was not acceptable. And so I called my half-sister. You know, as I mentioned, most of my family was in California when I moved there. I was born there. And I had a half-sister who was in recovery. And when she and I would talk, she had this way of taking all of my bullshit and just fanning it off. Like, you'll be fine. Don't sweat it. On to the next. She wouldn't buy into it. She wouldn't feed into the drama. And for some reason, that was very attractive to me. You know, outside of the attention that I got for being a crazy drunk chick in a bar, different kind of reaction. Something about that I found really appealing. So I called her, and we'd spent some time when I was drinking and whatever. So she knew what I was, clearly. You know, father is now in AA. He'd been in AA for a long time. My mom finally got sober. She'd been sober for a long time. So I was around AA, which was good and maybe not so good. But that's, I'll save that for another time. So I called Darcy, and I said, hey, I had a really bad night last night, so I'm going to kill myself. She goes, okay, cool. Let's go get coffee first. Which, I mean, that was Darcy. That in and of itself was the magic, right? Like, she's not going to do it. So she picked me up, and she had a friend with her, and we went and had coffee. And I talked about what had happened and what I was feeling. And she goes, yeah, buddy, you're an alcoholic like me. It's okay. You know, dad has it. Your mom has it. It's just one of those things you're just going to have to deal with. Are you ready to go to a meeting? And I said, yeah, I'm ready to go to a meeting. So I went to a meeting that day, and there was a guy in the meeting, and I saw him, and I ran out the door. And I went and smoked a cigarette, and he comes out. He goes, what are you doing here? I go, what are you doing here? And he said, well, I'm a junkie, man. He goes, you didn't know that? I go, no. He goes, he was just at my house the day before, and I'd made him an avocado sandwich, and he just, like, he was sick, like drug sick, so he went upstairs and vomited it up. And I didn't know that. Like, I didn't know anything. And I just, my jaw dropped. I go, are you serious? He goes, well, yeah. Like, haven't you seen me? I'm green. Like, you don't know that I'm a junkie? I'm like, no, you were my hero. You're my people. So he grabbed me. We hugged. We smoked a cigarette. That was, you know, the first meeting I'd ever been to. And I've been around ever since. And it was that moment when I walked in. I sat all the way through the meeting, and I was shaking, not because I was detoxing, because I was in fear. And I heard what I needed to hear in that meeting. And what I heard was, we're survivors, we're all survivors off the same sinking ship. Take what you need and leave the rest. Those were such profound statements for me, because that meant that I wasn't alone, and that we weren't all alike. We're all different people, but we all survived the same kind of insanity that I'd survived. What I thought was not survivable. The shame, the self-hatred, the anger, the rage, the anxiety. Everybody I knew in those rooms, or I learned about, shared and touched on some form of the same defects of character that I'd had. And a lot of those people in that room had the same family of origin stuff that I did. So for the first time, not only did I feel accepted, I felt like I wasn't alone, which was, you know, monumental. And so they said go to 90 and 90. I went to 5 and 5 because I was busy. I had a job, you know, but it worked. It worked for me. I'm not saying that's good for everybody, but, you know, I would go to meetings, and I would keep my head down. I'd show up late, and I'd leave early. And I started going to the same meeting kind of repeatedly, and I'd sneak in the back, and I'd grab a cup of coffee, and I'd hide out, and then I'd take off. And then people started to see me and recognize me, and they go, hey, Emily, you want to read? No. They, you know, when you walk into the room, there's greeters often in a lot of the meetings in Los Angeles where I got sober. So, you know, I felt like an animal. I felt like it was impossible for me to make eye contact with people, let alone touch anybody. It was horrifying. So I'd walk into a room and someone would immediately reach out their hand and take mine and look me in the eye. And I remember, like, shaking. And a guy took my hand in both of his hands and he said, you know, it's okay. You're safe, right? And I started crying. And I was just like, oh, God, this is not what I want. I don't want to cry in front of a bunch of people. So I had some real vanity issues that I needed to get over. And, you know, the women in the room that I got sober in were really super powerful women, and they circled up around me. They surrounded me, and they guided me, and they did for me what I couldn't do for myself. So the first 30 days, I didn't identify as an alcoholic because I was too afraid. The room was huge. There were 250 people in this room. It's a big-ass podium, speakers, just huge. So there was no way that I was going to stand up and identify as an alcoholic. So one girl had the chip commitment, and she stood up. She goes, and Emily has 30 days tonight. And so I stood up, reluctantly, shaking. My whole body was shaking. And I stood there, and I grabbed the podium, and I went, like, I couldn't even say my own name. But from that moment on, I realized that that fear is going to kill me. That fear is going to keep me separate and not a part of. And so I watched people get vulnerable, and I watched people hurt, and I watched people be crazy, and I watched people share their truth. And then I got to a place where I wanted to be a part of. I would continuously hear stories about, hey, I stopped going to meetings, you know, or hey, I never got a sponsor, or I wasn't of service. And I started hearing about these facets of recovery that I wasn't really participating in. I would just show up to a meeting now and then, and I started to feel really sick. I could feel, you know, the emotional, you know, darkness sort of creeping in again. And, you know, I actively just did what everyone told me to do, because I wanted what you had. I wanted to be able to sit in a chair for an hour and not want to peel my flesh off. I wanted to be able to walk in a room and hug people and see and be joyful and feel joy. And I, you know, the only way that I was going to successfully make that happen was to walk through that fear, was to say to myself and to the God of my understanding at that point that if you want me to do this, you're going to have to help me, because this is really super scary, and I don't know that this is right. It feels okay, but I'm horrified. And so I just started taking, you know, opposite action, living counterintuitive to what was normal for me. So I started gently shaking hands with people, with the greeters, instead of, you know, pushing my way through and like pushing their hands away. I started looking people in the eye, which was really scary. And if I needed to cry, I would go to the bathroom and have a moment, you know, let it out. People would ask for my phone number, so I'd give them my phone number. This is, you know, before cell phones, and, you know, you've got an answering machine, and every time the phone rang and someone would leave a message, delete, delete. I just, you know, I wasn't ready for that. But I realized, you know, soon that if I didn't start becoming a part of, like I said, I was going to end up in a lot of trouble. So I got a sponsor. It was my sister. My half-sister was my first sponsor. And I worked the steps with her, and we got to the fourth step, and I wrote a biography. And she was like, did you read the book? Because we might want to workshop that again. But it was actually really great that I sort of wrote a biography, because I was able to take the power out of a lot of what I thought my life looked like. You know, there's this thing that they say in Alcoholics Anonymous in the book, or in the 12 and 12, where we're described as having magical magnifying minds. And, you know, for me, my perception was deeply skewed on what life was like outside my own head, and, you know, what had really transpired in my addiction. And so I went back and I did another four step, and I did it by the book, and it was very succinct and it was unemotional for the most part. And I learned a lot about my sickness. And I, you know, learned that it was, at some point, it was going to be okay to forgive myself for what had happened and for what I had done, which was pretty remarkable, because I hated myself. So, you know, I continued to work the steps and show up for meetings and live in opposite action. And I relied heavily on page 99 in the 12 and 12, which is the St. Francis of Assisi prayer, which is all about, you know, opposite action. And where there is darkness may bring light. You know, when there is discord, you know, may bring calm, et cetera, et cetera. It's a really powerful page, paragraph on 99. And I remember I would often read that and just start crying, because I didn't know it was possible to love like that and to allow love like that to happen in my life. It was so awe-inspiring and monumental. I had a sponsor for a long time when I was living in LA before I moved to Austin. She actually had less time than I did, but She was a conduit. She was a spiritual advisor. And she lived through stuff that I didn't know anyone could live through. And she said to me, you know, when I got to AA, I had a heart of stone. And she should have had a heart of stone. It's surprising that she made it to AA, because her story is that intense. And she taught me how to love through service. So, you know, fairly early in recovery, you know, once I was pretty deeply enmeshed in the steps, I started going to H&M. And I would go to jails and learn how to share honestly, openly, and candidly about my, you know, my disease and my recovery. And I got a heart full of humility. I no longer was the most important person in the room. And my story was very insignificant. You know, I thought my story was boring. And it is, really. But that's okay. It's my story, and it's, you know, it's what I need to stay alive. There's something magical that happens when we help, or for me, when I help another alcoholic. And even if I work with someone who doesn't want it, you know, who's just there because they have to be there, there's still some kind of magic. And I do believe it all circles around selflessness and willingness, willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. And I got to a place where I was absolutely willing to go to any lengths to stay sober because it started to feel so good. The rewards, the promises that they talk about in these rooms are a truism. The relationship that I had with my higher power evolved, and it has evolved a lot over the past 25 years. But in early recovery in particular, because the God that I had was a mean, you know, habit-wearing, ruler-smacking, Catholic nun God. It was a God that put me in a home with a violent, angry, alcoholic, predatory mother. It was a God that seemed to have forgotten about me. And I learned that there are, some are sicker than others, and I still need to be available and willing to try to help. And I've, you know, gone to, I was in a panel once, which scared the hell out of me. It was a jail, and a girl got up just angry and grabbed a trash can and threw it at me, one of those big metal trash cans, and I was like, okay, but for the grace of God, there go I. Where's the exit? I'm good. But, you know, I left. I could leave, you know? Like, I didn't end up in jail. I didn't end up, you know, getting busted for DUIs, you know, underage drinking, you know, hanging out in a house where guys made drugs. Like, I don't know why I didn't, because I should have, and I should have been dead many times over, swimming in the ocean in the middle of the night, loaded out of my ass, trying to not drown, because my body was so heavy from the alcohol. I don't know how I made it to shore. So I look back, as many of us will and do, on our lives in recovery and realize that there's a purpose for this, all of this. And for me, it's not just getting sober, although that's a huge gift. It is to help others to achieve sobriety. If there's nothing else that I do right in this life, that's all I want to do right. And, you know, the love that I have in my heart for Alcoholics Anonymous, the gifts that you have given me, the friendships, the marriage that I've had with the same man for 17 years. We've been together for 21 years. And I always say this, he needs his own chip. Like, he needs his own chip for being married to a crazy alcoholic woman for 17 years, you know. He would show up at meetings for me. You know, just, and the interesting thing is, and I know some of you will find this, is it's sometimes it's really difficult when good stuff happens. It's really scary because I don't know about you, I didn't feel very deserving of it. And I still have a hard time with good things. You know, if I'm gifted something, I want to fall on the ground and kiss your feet. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. I want to hug you a million times, but it's like, it's okay. A thank you will suffice, you know. But, you know, coming from a place where I had to fight desperately to get what I needed, you know, to get help to study, to get help to eat. You know, I was feeding myself, you know, 4 or 5 years old, just trying to figure out how to survive, you know. And that, I think, was a big part of why I was able to stay alive until I found recovery, is just that survival mechanism. And, you know, the defects of character are a bitch, and they are the gift that keep on giving, for sure. But I'll tell you, it's a good thing, because you don't appreciate the light without the dark. And I will always embrace those defects of character, but they don't rule my life. And I don't make decisions as often based on those defects of character. And I don't follow people home after they cut me off in traffic anymore. I can't say that, you know, I hadn't done that in recovery. Maybe twice, honestly, just twice. And I can't say that I haven't bowed up to some people, but you know, I always feel really horrible after something like that happens, man. You know, the emotional hangover is a real thing. But you know, based on the practical application of the 12 steps, the disciplines, and there's a lot of freedom and discipline, a lot. I have found great peace, great joy. And even in those, you know, horribly painful 3 a.m. anxiety-ridden moments, and I do have those, for sure, where I wake up and the whole world is spinning and my head wants to explode because I can't control the outcome of what's going to happen in 6 months or 3 months or tomorrow. I literally start the mantras. And, you know, a big part of recovery for me is retraining my brain. You know, I liken it to running a marathon or any kind of extended goal, where learning a language, where you have to repeatedly do something. You know, the brain is a muscle. You know, you change the way you think by changing the way you think. And so, you know, there's a reason why we have to continuously go to meetings. It's to hear our truth, to share our truth, and also, you know, to remember how important, you know, the principles, the steps, and the traditions are. You know, I have to keep my ego in check, and my ego is my fear. And I have to remain deeply connected to my higher power to find any peace in this life. And I trust that even in those darkest moments, and they get really dark, that my higher power will get me to the other side. But I have to actively do things like I would if I had any kind of progressive disease. If I had cancer, if I had heart disease, if I had diabetes, I would actively be taking medicine to feel better and to stay alive. I have a progressive disease that will kill me, but it will also annihilate everybody around me as well. That's the difference. And, you know, the hurting of another because of my defects of character hits me really hard. Like, I feel it deeply. I made an amends last night because I was super hungry. And my friend came over, and I was like, I need to eat now. I need to eat now. I need to eat now. Like, losing my mind. He was like, are you okay? I was like, I'm an ass. I'm sorry. But, like, that resonates deeply. You know, if I don't show up for someone when I say I'm going to show up, I can't do that. The path gets really narrow, and that's a really good thing. There's not enough room for me to bullshit anybody else, let alone myself now. And that is, you know, an amazing gift, and that is a freedom that comes from, again, practically applying the steps in my everyday life. There's a lot I'm powerless over, and there's a lot I'm unmanageable over. And sometimes I just have to put pen to paper, and it's cause and it's effect. The cause is, you know, I'm anxious because I don't know if I'm going to have a job in September. Well, what's the unmanageability like? Well, I don't sleep well at night. I fear that my finances will, you know, falter. I fear that I'm going to lose my house, and I could make an entire story out of it. But what I have to do is get it in writing, because if I let it, any of it, whatever it may be, run rampant in my consciousness, it will build and build and build like an infection. And I got a clean house constantly. And I have conversations with my God like I do to you right now. I'll be in a car driving, and I'll just start talking to God. You know, hey, you know, I'm nervous about whatever, going to speak at AR. So can you just speak through me? Can you make sure that I don't come from a place of ego? And if I do make mistakes, that I can forgive myself? And maybe can I carry a message? Thank you, God. Do you have a lighter? I don't have a lighter. Anyway. So, you know, those, you know, having the ability and the gift of, you know, finding a higher power of your own understanding is something that, to me, is one of the most important things about recovery, because there are times often where no one's going to answer the phone because it's late at night. And so I've got to lean in. And who am I going to lean in on? I've got to lean in to my version of a God. And I do often. And I feel like I'm kind of coming to a close. But I will say that if I'd had a chance to trade this in, if someone would have come to me and said, look, I can guarantee you a better life, you'll be fine if you drink, I would never have traded. I'll give you $1 million. I'll give you $10 million. No. This is the most, it's difficult to put words to it, but often I think about recovery, I think about the gifts of recovery, and I just cry because I'm so overwhelmed, because I came from such a dark place, and I see your faces, and I see the hope in your faces, and I know that sometimes it doesn't feel great, but give it a minute. Do the work. Understand there's freedom and discipline, and you will get to the other side. And you could make a list right now of what you hope will happen in your life, and you will surpass that. I guarantee you that. Stick around. This is pretty awesome. Thank you.